Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll also hear John KT2WGB call into WS2N and allocate what you can get. That group of four guys is for us there. We run this thing called the Segment, which means every Sunday night for the last 31 years, starting in 1982. This is Segment number 1510 of the series. This is a gathering of people who like to know a little bit more about ham radio. 26 different kinds of ham radio. To me, the FM, what you're listening to right now, is just one of those kinds. The main common denominator of this group, in my opinion, is that they are NFL members. NFL stands for Not Finished Learning. So these guys want to know a little bit more about how all the jazz works. And a smart person, in my opinion, realizes that education never really ends. You're always learning new things as new things are being developed from the job. And there are certainly lots of new things being developed for ham radio. Just take a look at the Joe Taylor technique, the K1JT. He's a Nobel laureate who came up with a digital technique by which you can get about 20 decibels more sensitivity out of the ham radio receiver. It used to take, on 432, for instance, 16 good Yagis aimed at the moon in order to do moon bounce. People are now doing it, one or two Yagis aimed at the horizon, and Yagis are mounted to the chimney of the house. Once they're using a Joe Taylor technique. So, you haven't heard the end of the story yet. There's more to come. There's a bright future of all the stuff that NASA is developing and ham radio operators are developing on the job. John's going to be monitoring on the technet, on the internet, those who are signing in by IRLP and Echolink in particular. So that in the past, people have had great trouble signing in with Echolink. John, by way of his monitoring, will know that you have made the attempt. He'll give us the word right away to stand by for you. Also, there are ways you can send messages to John during the technet. I'm not sure if it's done directly on the internet or it's done by way of the chat room. In fact, I'll turn it over to you, John, for a couple of words on that. KT2WGV, K2LIW.
That's correct, Duke. They can type it right in on Echolink if they wish, or the chat room. In fact, I have a question ready for Jim when the time comes for the mailbag, which I'll be presenting. But either one will do.
So you can tell the menu of the technet is slowly improving, slowly changing. One of the frequent complaints we've had in previous years was that a person who's far outside of the area and signing in by way of Echolink, because most of us will be jumping the gun between transmissions, not enough delay time, even though Eric did put in four separate beats that we usually listen for. Even those four beeps sometimes are not long enough when the latency of the system builds up so that a person outside of the area seems to be locked out, so to speak. By way of us monitoring that Echolink website, we now know that you're there. We know that you're making the attempt. Okay, person signs into the technical net. I give John, Paul, and me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Need not sign in just to let us know you're listening. And for 31 years, we believe somebody is listening. And by the way, for those who, let me drop. For those who can't stay up for the whole thing and are afraid of missing something, it starts at 8 o'clock and ends at midnight when they turn off the machine on us. All of the technets for the last 6.5 years are recorded on that website by the first of the two mics. K2RJI, Mike in New Jersey, who has a website called amateurradio.tangovictor. You go to amateurradio.tangovictor, and most of the last 6.5 years of TechNet are there recorded. Choose the right year, the right month, the right week, the right reel. They come in four reels in 1 hour each, and listen to them. 8 o'clock the next morning on their way to work or in that noon hour or whatever, because they can't stay up that late. That's one approach. Another very good website to know about is EverMic, the Mike and Mike website. KONMJM has a website that's entitled, the URL is limarknet.com. And there you'll see some pictures of some of the people involved and some of the past articles and whatever. So these are two developing websites that are continuously expanding in their data. And as such, there are other ways to keep track. And also, the LIMARC website itself, LIMARC.org, gives you a tremendous amount of information if you can find what you're looking for there, because it's on many things. So now you're going to give us the check-in. You're going to give us your call letters, your name, and the word yes means you do have a question or a comment. T2LA, they'll be listening.
And to Leo, Rich, and comment through the net, take in to Leo.
Rich recognized, anyone else?
Anybody have a question that you spoke to for the phone?
List for next week. Thank you.
Okay, I heard the word list for next week. Please repeat that message, call letters and message.
WHYYY Joe. Question, yes. You can put me on the head of the list for next week. Thank you.
Okay. Would anything bad happen if I put you near the head of the list this week, Joe? Go ahead.
Yes, I don't have time to get into it this week. It's probably a good question, but I just don't have time this particular night to do that. Just have enough time to check in. I have to go.
Okay. I may pass it over to you for you to just tell us the subject matter, even though we can't get into it. Okay, we've got Rich, Joe, Wes. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
WS2N Paul with the Space Report. Good evening, Dick. John, Al. Back to you, Dick.
Ready.
Keep in.
Okay, we got Paul and TBN. TBN, when I do come back to you, are you going to be there or will you be away at that time?
Toby 2, BBN, yes.
Okay, let's hope that Freddy really is there this time. Sometimes I go back to Freddy, he's gone. One last call. Anyone else can check into the technique? Give me your call letter and name right now. We have more than enough to get started. I know that Rich wants to make a comment, so go right ahead, Rich. N2EO, T2LAW.
Okay, Dick, good evening, and Cleo. Just want to help other people. I have diabetes. Smoking. I'm down blood flow. You good?
I listened to you on the input there, Rich. Someone in the Best Page area is jamming you. I'm sorry to say we didn't hear any of that. Let me go on to the next person, Joe. to B2RYY. Give us the subject matter, Joe. B2RYW.
Can you relay that?
One more call, Joe, to B2RYY. Want to tell us just a subject matter, even though you haven't got time to get into it? Go ahead, Joe. Okay, Freddy, tell us what you'd like to talk about tonight. From Far Rockaway, KB2EBM, KB2RYW, go ahead, Freddy. Each time we go back to Freddy on the tech net, he's not there. I guess tonight, will he be there when we go back to him? He said he would. H2BBN, H2RIW, go ahead, Freddy.
H2RIW, and...
Yes, this is N2MB. I can hear Fred on the input. Evidently, he's having trouble making the repeater, but he's quite strong on the input. So, Fred, if you make the transmission again, I will relay it, N2MB.
Very good, Barry.
This is Fred, it's KB2EN. I want to know if it's covered on your repeater right now. More. 2 to 3 weeks.
So
we have over here in the area.
Okay. A very chopped up transmission. I heard season. I'm in the area. Maybe you're asking about propagation and the fact that we get sporadic heat propagation at this time. So Barry, you're hearing him very well. And two moonbound, please relay. Keep your eyes up here in the deck, man.
Let's ready to try one more time.
Yeah, Freddy, give us the message one more time. And speak softly. Sometimes the machine jumps out of people over DBA. KB2EBN, KB2RIW, go ahead, Freddy.
This is KB2EBN. I want to know if this is hurricane tornado season right now. Can the repeater and landmark sustain the power for more than 2 weeks in case the empty power goes out over here in Long Island?
Okay, we heard all of that that time. Got a good question. So if the power goes out because of hurricanes, Superstorm Sandy, and things like that, you want to know, would the Limark repeater with its standby power be on the air for 2 weeks? Does it have a power source? I know its batteries are going to keep it on the air for X number of hours. And I'm reasonably sure there's a way of charging those batteries. So I'm pretty sure that some Limark members available, KE2EJ in particular, who can give us some more information about how long this particular repeater can stay on the air. During Hurricane Sandy, it stayed on continuously, even though I think more than a million Long Islanders were without power. So anyone with any further information about Limark emergency power and capability, you can tell us what you know. Give me your call letters right now. B2RIW. There's the man I'm looking for. Give us enough audio and take your time. Go right ahead, Eric.
Alright,
good.
Let me tell you, gentlemen, this is Glen Oaks. It runs from not Con Ed power, not micro power, but power that's generated locally on the site of the North Shore Towers. They have their own power plant, and they generate their electricity by natural gas. Assuming that atomic bombs that go off, and all the power goes out everywhere, they will continue to operate. The other side, this side playing through the VHF, and this side sells them to the VHF. They're generated back up. They know your PI, so the power goes down, generators kick in, takes another 20 or 30 seconds to the level of speed, and the power comes back. It's a lot of
Yeah, that's very encouraging. So Glen Oaks, natural gas, into their own local generator, they stay on the air. Out of curiosity here, Eric, Glen Oaks, do they have the ability to switch over to ConEd power as well as standby generator power? And I'm going to guess they run on ConEd power 99% of the time. Only their own local generator is turned on during a failure of ConEd. Is that roughly true, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, the way I understand it is they don't ever use ConEd power. They simply on their own system. How cost effective that is, I couldn't answer that question, but that's what they do.
U.S.2N.
And WF2N, they'll recognize both of you in a second. I guess what they're doing, because the Sudan many very important communication systems located at that site, I guess they want something.
They don't care. It was there long before that stuff was there.
So it's not there for uninterruptible power. You think it's just there for tradition? Amazing. Go ahead, Paul. WF2N, K2RIW.
I was young. I went there to visit somebody. I was a mechanic, and they had 100%, like Eric says, capability. I mean, their plan was to run that 24/7. So all the three buildings. I guess they continued that all through the decades. But yeah, that's what they had. I was kind of surprised to see that. I believe it was all oil fed at the time. It was probably both. Maybe they had both capabilities of gas or the oil back then.
Yeah, let me ask this to both Eric and Paul in that order. The generators at Glen Oaks, are they just for all the radio equipment at the top of the three buildings?
It is this one. I am complex. The entire facility, every single building.
Question.
Yeah, John recognized. Fantastic. Make a rough guess, Eric. How many kilowatts or megawatts is required? Each of these are a 33-story building. There's three of them. You've got a total of almost 100 stories. There must be 10,000 human beings living there. Make a rough guess as to how much power they've got to generate to keep all of that happy. And we're in the megawatts here, aren't we, Eric?
Yeah, let's put it this way. I've got on my property just 10.5 megawatts generated. But this building generates the rest of I don't know. If I had to take a rough guess, they're probably doing something like 20 megawatts in that neighborhood.
Did I hear you say there's a separate generator in each building, Eric?
Negative. There's a central air conditioning and power plant. One generates chilled water, and the other one generates electricity. And the big building that's not part of the main complex is off to that.
So from time to time, I look with Google Earth down at those buildings, and I like seeing that three-dimensional view, if you know what I mean. I do the same thing with the Eiffel Tower, and I've made some hard copies of prints of that. So there is a separate building from the three that houses the air conditioning and the power generation, is what I think you're saying, Eric. Go ahead and pick up a little bit.
Yeah, if you look on Google Earth, you'll see there's a building with a lot of fans on it. That's the one.
Okay, I'll take a look for that. KC2WGD, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
By the way, all the other sites, the UPS back, trying to stay alive and feel the generator kicks in.
I was going to get to those next. John, you got it.
Eric and Paul, thank you. Know, is that a cogeneration facility or is it isolated?
It's 100% isolated.
Things might have changed, but just like Eric said, that they actually consider it a powerhouse, that's their own powerhouse. That's
my goodness, are they independent? Okay, now, when it comes to your site in Plainview, Eric, and the site at Adirondack Drive in Tilden, I think you said that they are UPS-backed, then generator, and I'm going to guess each of those are an oil-fired generator, and I'm going to guess that there's enough oil supply for a good number of days, maybe even weeks, and of course that is replaceable under emergency conditions. Might want to say a couple words along those lines there. Freddie's original question is that would we, on those three sites, on the air for 2 solid weeks, in a worst case a scenario, KE2EJ, KE2LIW.
KE2LIW, KE2EJ. Okay, let me qualify that. The computers and all the control stuff is on UPS, the actual power amps and radio themselves to the set from the line, so, you know, they'll be off the air for the station that there's no power. But you don't have to wait for anything from, you know, 3 to 4 minutes. Besides, the computers are happy when they don't get banged. The radio good, doesn't really care. The big brute force, power supply, it's dealt with adverse conditions in mind, so. Those radios generally aren't sensitive to power, I'm just blowing them up. Unless, of course, you go way over voltage, which is what never happened to them. Although, my TV transmitters, that's another story. They take raw power, turn it into more raw power, and whatever happens on the power line happens on the transmitter. Definitely in the analog days. The generators themselves, when it's up for a second. Now, I actually don't know what the capacity of the generators at our site, so I know what mine is. I got 1,500 gallons, and that lasts me about, my transmitter runs, that'll last me about 4.5 days. But, I assume that when they built the size, when they were fully loaded with pages and all that kind of stuff, they sized the generator for that at that point in time. Now that all that stuff is gone, you could probably assume that their runtime is going to double as much. But I suspect that they've got at least a week's worth of fuel with everything fully loaded, so you bet it's a little bit more than that. And, yeah, they're diesel. It's YWK2J.
During Hurricane Sandy, a fair number of people were standing on lines trying to get gas to run their generators. And not very many people were standing in line trying to get diesel fuel, because very few people have a diesel-powered generator at their private home. But I would like to believe that you're good for, let me pick a number, a week's worth of diesel fuel at your site in Plainview at your broadcast transmitter. And I suspect you wouldn't have a great deal of trouble getting an emergency delivery of more fuel if need be. Because, except for the dead of winter, people are not really demanding a lot of oil during a hurricane situation. Am I getting close to right on any of those guesses, Eric? KE2EJ, KE2LIW.
KE2LIW, KE2EJ. Well, there's a couple of things to bear in mind here when you're dealing with diesel generators. First of all, you're not buying heating oil. You can't buy that stuff in it. And you're not buying the diesel fuel that goes into tropical cars, which have the dye in it, which indicates that the road taxes are paid on it. You're actually getting free diesel, believe it or not, which doesn't have all the soap and the other extra stuff in it. It's a bit cheaper, And your fuel delivery guy may have to wait a bunch of hours at the terminal and get his stuff, but we were able to get fuel while everybody else is, online, hoping they can get fuel. But you did have to wait like 3 or 4 hours at the terminal to get to fill up your truck so they could, bring the 2,000 gallons here.
Now, I've been maintaining my own oil burner furnace at my home for 40 years, and I also buy oil on the spot market, so to speak. In other words, I have them deliver it to me when I request it. As long as I buy 200 gallons and pay cash on the barrel head, I get oil for numbers like $3.69 when the people with a contract are paying $4.35 a gallon. That to me makes a lot of difference after a few years, if you know what I mean. I'm amazed that people will go for the contract where they pay a higher price for the oil. They pay a number of hundreds of dollars for the contract. The guy who's delivering oil is the same guy who's adjusting their furnace. That's a conflict of interest because the furnaces are being adjusted very rich on oil, making a sooty flame, making a lot of soot that has to be cleaned out. A furnace running correctly doesn't make black soot, an oil-fired furnace. It makes a very small amount of tan-colored deposit on the flue pipes. It takes 4 or 5 years for enough of it to build up and you really have to clean it. And that tan-colored stuff is the mineral material that's in the oil that doesn't burn. Everything else is thoroughly oxidized. It's got the mixture set right. And Erwin Dresner, Limark had that contract a decade or two ago from Brookhaven Laboratory to investigate people's home oil furnaces and found that a high percentage of them were being misset in the way that I just described. Amazing situation to me when I got there. And we amateurs who have got the smarts to maintain some pretty sophisticated electronics have been brought up to believe that oil-fired furnace maintenance is rocket science, and it is simple as all hell. And you go to a Dick Harvey store that will sell you all the parts you want. They've got a $20 big white book. I call it the white book. It's an 8.5 by 11 book with about 100 pages. You buy that $20 book, and you read it with a beautiful diagram, and you become an oil burner expert almost. And so maintenance is not that difficult. And in my case, now what I was getting at is that on a couple of occasions I cut it too close where the oil tank did become empty. So I drive down to the local gas station with oil containers and buy a few gallons of diesel fuel intended for an automobile and forward it to my oil tank. I go through a priming procedure and my furnace is now running again until the next delivery can take place. So that plus the standby of parts that I've got. I could get a furnace failure at 2 o'clock in the morning on Christmas morning, so to speak. I don't have to wait for a service person. I fix it myself. So it gives me a feeling of confidence. And the fact that more people are not doing that is kind of amazing to me. So from what I can tell, Eric, the diesel fuel that I can buy at a gas station, which doesn't contain a red dye, and the diesel fuel that is delivered... The number two fuel oil that's delivered to my house, the furnace unit, which does have a red dye in it, except for the red dye, I have reason to believe that they're very close to the same fuel. My furnace doesn't know the difference, if you know what I mean. And the fact that you're buying a fuel without additives that's a little bit lower in price, does that make it more vulnerable to wax buildup? Give us a few more words on that one, Eric.
Thank you. Repeater, time out.
Sorry, I turned it out. K2EJ, give us a few more words on that one, Eric. K2LAW. K2LAW, K2EJ. Yeah, there's a few differences between the fuel oil that's supposed to be home and the fuel oil that's refined to your motor vehicle. There's a slight difference between that and the fuel oil designed to range. It's a combination of which,
they're all supposed to be low sulfur, but the sulfur content in the home heating oil is a little bit higher than the people feel. There's some other differences, but that's what they are. As far as its ability to wax up, I believe the temperatures in which they start waxing up are similar to the marine and the fuel that they float. As far as the difference in temperatures between the palm heating oil and the diesel fuel, I believe that I could be wrong, that the actual temperature that the crack is a little bit higher, not by much. But anyway, what do I do? It's RIWK, 3-3.
Yeah, I think the only real difference in oil-like petroleum products, and I think there's something called the number 4 fuel oil, real thick black stuff, that's burned in the furnaces of some large industrial buildings and apartment buildings. And there, I don't know much about it. Maybe you do, Eric. Looks like John and everybody knows something about it. Who thought of it, John, first? And tell us about number 6 fuel oil. And is that such a thick sludge that you have to heat it before it'll even flow? KC2WGB, KQLXW.
Yes, that has to be preheated before it goes into the injectors, and that's what the ships use. They'll use a finer oil when they're coming into the harbor. When they're out of sea, they'll burn 6, so they can afford to pump that stuff into the air. But if it's used in a building, yeah, it has to be preheated. It's ugly stuff.
Give me a couple more words on that ugly stuff. I guess in the refinement process, this is a thick goo left at the bottom of the container where they're doing the petroleum refinement. Maybe it contains mysterious substances that don't burn as well. And it doesn't sound like it's a clean burning fuel if they only use it out at sea. However, if it's being used in apartment buildings that are not out at sea, tell me how the EPA is happy with that, or is the furnace in an apartment building somehow very special so that it can thoroughly oxidize the sludge, if you know what I mean? KC2WGB, KQLAW.
Well, Dick, maybe Paul would know, but I don't know if they're allowed to burn 6 anymore. I know schools used to burn it after their conversion from coal. The ones that were burning it, because of the contaminants and the particulates, they had to have electrostatic precipitators in the stacks. Whether they're still doing that I'm not aware of. But yeah, it even smells different than regular number 2 burning, like in your home. It has a more acidic odor to it.
I just looked it up. The big difference is that one has a lot more sulfur. Burn that it's real.
Yeah, Eric, you said your words very low. I think you said it's a higher sulfur content. Is that what you said, Eric?
Yeah, I'm looking at a couple of different websites now. They say that the home heating oil has a higher sulfur content, whereas the stuff that's designed for the vehicle has a very low sulfur content.
Is there something about the refining process where it takes more man hours, more chemistry, more cooking, whatever, that makes the fuels that we use a little more expensive? And the number 6 is the sludge at the bottom of the container, so to speak. That's why it's being sold at a lower price, even though it's got a higher sulfur content. Is that roughly what's going on here? Eric, go ahead.
You know, I couldn't get into the classic process of the ball, although I do know that it's probably not
happening. NDQ. Okay, something. It sounds like NDQ. You can have some information on the subject. Give us your full call letters and your name, and then tell us what you'd like to tell us on this one. KQRIW, my name is Dick.
QNKQ, Tom here. I believe a gallon of 6 oil, Navy Special, versus a gallon of 2 oil is more latent heat in the 6 oil than there is in the 2.
Note that also when you look at the BTU per gallon, Tom, you look at the BTU per gallon for gasoline, which everybody considers a higher refined fuel, it doesn't have as many BTU per gallon as number 2 fuel oil. And so I guess when you go in that direction, the number 6 is getting an even higher number of BTUs. My guess is the difference is small. I think fuel oil is in the vicinity of 120,000 BTU per gallon. I'm going to guess that number 6 instead of 120 is maybe 125,000 BTU per gallon. Am I in the right ballpark there, Tom? Blank 2 NKQ. We keep missing the beginning. KQLIW, you got it, Tom.
Kilo Charlie, KQ2NKQ. I'm not 100% sure what it is. The Navy special that we used to use was, you had to heat it to 140 degrees before you could pump it. And then you also had to blow tubes in the boilers as well on a regular basis.
I believe that a number of LIPA Loco power generating stations on Long Island, a number of them did run on some form of oil. Does anyone know whether or not that was number 6 fuel oil? Thank you, LAW. Looks like we don't know on that one. Anyone have any further information about oil? By the way, I keep forgetting Irwin Dresner's call letters. W2GRP, one of the near founders, if not a founder, of Limark. So Irwin was the guy who, as I said, about 20 or so years ago, had this contract with Brookhaven Laboratory to investigate the proper or improper setting of the oil-fired furnaces that were in private homes on Long Island. And that's where he discovered that a high percentage of them were being misset. And it's sad because quite a few of my friends have the opinion that an oil-fired furnace is smelly, dirty, noisy. All three of those are not required when it's set correctly. It's clean, quiet, and doesn't make carbon monoxide or whatever. When you do thorough atomization, thorough oxidation of the fuel because of the proper amount of oil-fuel setting, and when you have a nozzle that is small enough, opposite of common sense, you would think to be double darn sure, you make sure a nozzle in your furnace is set so that it has a high enough number of gallons per hour. And if you go in the opposite direction, you buy a smaller and smaller nozzle that gives you less and less gallons per hour. And you also are smart enough to buy the pressure gauge and reset the controls on your fuel pump for your furnace, which is therefore pumping oil into the nozzle at 150 pounds per square inch instead of 100. Get a hell of a lot better atomization, a much finer spray, so to speak, much cleaner burn. And if you buy, if you go to the right website, Alvin, I think is the brand name, one of the major brand names of nozzle. When you Google the word oil-fired nozzle, and you download that, I guess it's about a 50-page article, and you read it, you say,
repeater, time out.
As I said, you get that article on nozzles. Everything you want to know about nozzle, we're afraid to ask. That's not the title, but that's what the title should be. Gives you a lot of information. Well illustrated, well described. You read that, and that's the second half of the information you need to do a really good job of maintaining your own furnace. The $20 book from Sid Harvey, and the nozzle book from the website, and with that information in hand, you'll have the confidence to do the maintenance, to do the setting, to make the system burn clean and quiet, and work a hell of a lot better, and burn a hell of a lot less oil. I am guessing by all those changes that I made, probably cut down my fuel oil consumption per year down to about 60% of what it used to be, and that's before I added in the insulation to the house. So, as I said so many times, not rocket science, it's well within the capability of a crafty ham radio operator. Anybody with any further questions or comments on all of the above, give me your call letters right now.
And I will send this for you.
Go right ahead, Eric.
Actually, at some point, when you're playing Rich into this conversation, I'll just read you a couple of sentences of two things I found. Several differences between heating oil and diesel fuel. Heating oil is usually has a low cloud point and no steam. Cloud point is the temperature which wax crystallizes in the fuel, plus the solar thing, thereby stopping it. Steam rating is the volatility of the fuel and indicates how rapidly it will water tonight. One form's got a low cloud point with high steam rating, hence it's a fuel choice in the winter, with starting off slow and critical. And the higher volatility, and it comes off it's more expensive. The regular stuff will stop you cold in temperatures below 25 degrees. So you get to ask any trucker what you'd ask them about this. They also say that most fuels are blended by season. They say that heating oil has no requirements for auto tanks unless there is requirements for air, sulfur, moisture, and other contaminants. Not harmful to an oil burner, but so for you. Anyway, that's a little tidbit. Enjoy the day. Why don't you ask Rich to chime in on that one?
Yes, you mean me, and who are you, Dick?
Yeah, concerning Rich, K2UP, you and I thought of him at the exact same time, Eric. I'm tracking Rich, K2UP, in his United Parcel Service truck. He's driving to the east at this time. He's very close to Pittsburgh. According to the ATRS, he's moving at 65 miles an hour, aimed at 22 degrees. And, Rich, you burn diesel fuel like it's going out of style. I think you, I believe you made two truck stops on the way down to Louisville last night. And my guess is that when you do fuel up, I'm guessing you pick up in the vicinity of 300 gallons. You are a significant vehicle that has eight drive wheels on it. You want to make sure that all those eight tires are in great shape. That's not the whole story. So tell us a little bit about the fuel that you burn and how you make sure that it's wax-free and going to run your diesel-powered tractor. A tractor trailer with sometimes two tandem trailers behind it. Give us a couple of words on how nice that fuel is, how happy it keeps your company rich.
Full reset, Dick.
Yeah, I'm gonna go to a full reset. Am I? Yeah, so KQUPS with a full reset. KQLIW.
Thank you.
KTUPS model. We do burn a lot of the fuel. We go through almost 1,000 gallons a week. We only get 5 miles a gallon, and we drive just about 5,000 miles, so we're burning just about 1,000 gallons every week. And it's, standard over-the-road diesel. We do not have to stop on the way to get it. 300 gallons is more than enough to get us one way. When we fill up the Louisville, we usually take on maybe 120 gallons, so we could probably make a round trip. This is what we carry, but I wouldn't want to risk it. You get on a steep hill or something and the fuel all slides into the back or forward and you might be fuel starved, and that's not a good situation. But all of the fuel, 90% of the fuel that we burn is from property. We don't fuel up on the road anymore unless it's an emergency situation. Back to you.
Very fine, Rich. Came through beautifully. Do they do anything special in the wintertime to make sure that the fuel in the tank that's being pumped into your vehicle is heated? I guess the fact that the tanks are so far below ground, they probably are at some nominal temperature all the time. So even though the air temperature might be minus 20, I'd like to believe the oil is coming out of the ground at plus 40 degrees Fahrenheit, so to speak. And so, I'm guessing all the electronics, all the mechanics of your vehicle, if the oil requires heating, before it goes into the injectors or goes into the fuel pump. You might very well have a couple of cascading filters, a heater, and so do they do anything at the place that supplies the fuel to you to make sure that it's at a reasonable temperature? In the worst case scenario I can think of, if all of the storage tanks were above ground for long periods of time, at minus 20 degrees, if you were being supplied fuel at minus 20 degrees, I think that wouldn't be a desirable situation. As you can tell, I'm making a bunch of guesses here, Rich. K2UPS, K2LA for the Intertech Man.
I can't vouch for when they deliver it. I mean, it just comes in normal tank trucks when they're bringing it in, but the tanks are below, at most of our facilities, at the airports, they're above ground. But at the all of our normal depots, they are below ground. They run different fuel blends during the winter, during the cold weather, to keep it fluid so it doesn't gel up. They put additives in it to keep that from happening. And the fuel pump on the engine supplies more fuel than the engine needs at any given point, even at full throttle. So the excess fuel is sent back to the tanks, and of course it's been heated. You notice that in the summertime more because the fuel tanks will start to get warm. Even though you're using the fuel up, you're putting warm fuel back into it, and it's the temperatures will rise up on the fuel tank. And we very rarely shut them down. Once we start it up at the beginning of the run, if we shut it down, it's just so the guards can cut the seals on the trailer, and then it's started right back up again. So the engine's running continuously just about the entire time that we're out here.
Here we go, Dick, for the comment.
Yeah, one last thing I was going to mention, John, here you go, Rich, that teaching UPS, that is. I recognize that where you went last night, Louisville, Kentucky, I suspect that is a major hub. I'm not sure if UPS was the truck, but I do remember a genius of a person knowing how to really do distribution correctly of packages 20 or so years ago came to the conclusion that everybody comes together at one particular spot, and then you redistribute the packages and send them out from there. Although it looks like you're spending more mileage toward delivering the package sometimes, the whole distribution process turns out faster and more efficient and less expensive. And maybe Louisville is the place where that takes place. I'm making a bunch of guesses here. I get the impression that a very major hub of your organization is at the Louisville Airport. That's True Rich, K2UPS, K2LAW.
It's the major, one of the major air hubs that we have, and it's the major one in the United States. But I think it's not so much where it was located as...
Yeah, there is the internet system and the connection to our repeater occasionally goes into this distortion mode where it sounds like people sideband off frequency, if you know what I mean. So unfortunately, 10 seconds into that beautiful transmission, it went into the distorted mode and we missed that message. So any portion of that you'd like to repeat, Rich, I'd like to hear it. K2UPS Mobile, near Pittsburgh, K2LIW in the TechNet.
I think hopefully this is better now. I said it really has more to do with the cost of the land, I'm sure, when they were looking where to put it. They had a general idea where they wanted to make this hub, and then they found probably the cheapest land that they could to make it cost effective. But it is a good location because you can reach, I think, something like 80% of the United States within a one-day drive of that spot.
Yeah, when I look at the Louisville Airport and the hub you go to there, it looks to me like it's in the southern end of that airport, but very close, in between I think it's 11 left and 11 right runway is where you're going. And if I zoom back out from there, I can see by the empty land around it, which is then surrounded by private homes. I'm guessing that where the Louisville Airport is now located once was a very large piece of farmland. So I think you're saying that to build the airport there was less expensive land, but to locate a hub there in the middle of an airport, that amazes me that that would be considered inexpensive land. Might have a couple of words on that one, Rich. KTUPS, KTULAW.
It's in between the runways. They share the runways with both the Louisville International Airport and the Air National Guard, Kentucky Air National Guard, at what they call Stanford Field, which is attached to the same airport pretty much, but they all share the same runways. And I don't know if they knew that it would be as big as it is now, but if you do, a Google satellite image, you'll see all, the trailers around and how big that facility is, how many planes it can handle. They couldn't do that if they tried to put a facility like that in Newark and Kennedy. There's just not enough space. They needed a completely separate place to do this. And at the time, that's what they chose. So, I mean, it worked out. We go in and out of about every major airport, but we have so many flights coming in and out every day that one airport is nowhere near enough to handle it.
Fantastic. Okay. By way of Amazon, I ordered a number of pods recently. Oh, I know you were involved in that delivery. You know what I mean, Rich? Fun stuff. Anyone with any further questions on whatever our subject is right now? Trucking, oil, furnaces for homes, and so on. Anyone with any further questions or comments? Give me your call letters right now. KQIW in the tech van.
Romeo, Dick, November 2, Echo Oscar, with a couple of comments that you could relay for me if there's a problem.
We can't spend the time, Rich, because whenever you try talking, somebody covers you up. And so, I'm sorry to say. Okay, I think we've gone down the list of people who signed in with these early questions, if you know what I mean. So I think it's time we go over to the mailbag. KC2WGB. KQIWB, go right ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick. Everyone on the deck. And, yes, 2 weeks ago, gentleman Jim sent an email to me asking questions about a gag. I posed the question last week. Apparently, he was not in attendance. Probably didn't have it to do. So I'm going to have to ask the question again. And you covered it very well, I'm sure you'll remember. He's asking about a three-element being and the relationship of the reflector and director, their distances and actually what they do. And that's basically the question. So give what you can on the gadget and the construction and why it's that way. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Very fine, John. Under normal circumstances, I would tell a person that all you've got to do is to play back the recording of what we said last week, and you would have that information. In this case, it didn't work. Mike, KQRJI, had a failure of the computer, and therefore last week's technet did not get recorded when we were giving the particular information about a yet. And Yagis are something that I've got a lot of enthusiasm for. If you go to the article, which is called Antenna Ratiometry and Outdoor Range Improvement Techniques, by way of an elaborate kind of antenna range I set up in my backyard, I was able to easily resolve gain increase or gain decrease of a Yag to the nearest 20th of a decibel, 0.05 dB I can see an increase or decrease. We've got that kind of an antenna range. It's carefully tuned into the elements of a 19 element yet, which is what I did. Spent 150 hours doing it. I did that way back in 1978. Let me drop.
Ready for the coming?
I said yes, you got a point of order on this one, go ahead.
Say, too, is what I'm told, W2LIE has recorded all the flying log stuff, you get it that way, and I also have a full recording of everything that goes on the repeater, so if you just send me an email at what time frame you want, I can send you the files in 2 minute intervals.
Very fine, Jerry. You're WB2ZEX. Now, I first would have to tell you what hour of last week that took place. You could only find out what hour it took place by listening to a recording, and the recording is not there. So, give us a few more words, Eric, Jerry, as to how a person could make a request to you in the form by which they could get that recording. W2ZEX, T2LIW.
I'm going to step in here for a second. What he needs to do is to turn the phone 8 o'clock on till midnight to WLIE. Let's put it on the website.
Okay. You said a lot of good sounding words, Eric. Does a person go to Lymont.org and by way of selecting the right push button, so to speak, he can now get recordings of what took place? I think there's a lot more involved. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
All right, I may have been spoken to a long call, but the guy who runs amateur radio TV, the recording of the gentleman was broken. Jerry could step in from 8 o'clock to midnight. He can install that on his website and still listen to the thing.
Excellent suggestion. So, I think you see what's going on here, Jerry, and maybe I guess, Jerry, you're in charge of making the recordings of everything that takes place on Lymont. Therefore, you have access to those files and could possibly send them to mic number one at amateurradio.tv. WP2ZEX for some further words. K2LAW. Go right ahead, Jerry.
Just send me an email with his email and I can send them the files from 8 o'clock until midnight. In 2 minute interval, I'll have to split the file up into many different emails, but I can send them the files. If you send me an email, wb2zx@aol.net or lymont.org with the guy's email address, and I can send them the files.
Okay, fine. Now, you said in 2 minute intervals. I'm getting the impression that you're... I heard 2, but it's 10. All right. So your recording system makes individual files of 10 minutes each, which I guess have to be cascaded or concatenated, so to speak, in order to make the normal one-hour reels that are on the amateurradio.tv website. Is that approximately it, Jerry?
If I think those sites of 2LIE may make 10-minute intervals, the software I have makes only 2-minute intervals, so I think it has to be headed up in 2-minute segments, and 2 minutes is about 1.6 meg, so I get about 20 minutes per email, assuming that they allow 20 minutes out, 20 meg files to send out on email. So, W2LIE may be recorded differently. He gets the feed from me, he may save it in 10-minute intervals. The software I have is 2 minute intervals.
Okay, if you're talking about that many megabytes per 2 minutes or per 10 minutes, the formatting of your particular recording might end up with 4 solid hours being a gigabyte. And maybe Mike number one's website can't tolerate that. Let's see, Eric, you're much more of a computer maven than I am. Is there the possibility that the number of megabytes per minute of audio, that there's multiple kinds of formats? I'd like to believe that each of the files that are being downloaded from amateurradio.tango